From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. As we inch closer to the presidential primaries next year, some states across the country are focused on updating their voter rolls by way of massive purges. Last week, Wisconsin removed more than 230,000 voters from their rolls. And this week, a federal judge in Georgia allowed the state to purge more than 300,000 inactive voters from the rolls. Democratic presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar actually brought this up in last night's debate.
Because you don't go to a church or a synagogue or a mosque for 3 months, you don't lose your right to worship. You shouldn't lose your right to vote.
A voting rights group founded by former Georgia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams challenged the removal of 120,000 inactive voters, arguing voters were unfairly penalized. And hours before a court hearing yesterday, the Secretary of State's office announced it was reinstating about 22,000 of those voters back on the rolls. Here to explain more is Emil Moffitt, a reporter with WABE in Atlanta. Hey, Emil.
Hi, Tanya. How are you?
I'm well. So before we get into yesterday's events, tell us why Georgia purged the rolls on Monday.
They did. 308,000 voters were removed. Brad Raffensperger, who is Georgia's Secretary of State, says the voter roll cleanup is necessary to retain the integrity of the elections, though there have been very few cases of voter fraud to report in Georgia. But he says people who've moved, people who have died definitely need to be removed. And he says they have to do their due diligence for voters who haven't participated in the last couple presidential elections and haven't responded to mailings asking, do you still live here?
We're not trying to hassle anyone, but the federal law requires us to update the voter rolls. And so we're just complying with federal law.
And it's 100,000 who haven't voted in 7 years and haven't had contact in years that were the subject of yesterday's hearings.
Okay, so Fair Fight, the voting rights organization which filed a lawsuit to stop Monday's purge, what's their argument?
Their argument is that no matter how long you haven't voted, no matter how long you've been out of touch with elections officials, that you should never, ever lose your right to vote and lose your space on the voter roll because you haven't been in contact or haven't voted. In the instance of these specific 100,000 people, they're asking for a new law to be applied to them as opposed to the old law.
Emil, what populations are most impacted by these voter roll purges?
We don't have a demographic breakdown on who this exactly affects, but there is concern that it may affect people in minority communities and people in rural areas. The Secretary of State's office has been very vocal about saying, hey, you can go to this website and check your voter registration status. But there are also lots of parts of Georgia that don't have access to high-speed internet to stay on top of their voter registration information.
So let's talk about what happened earlier this week. Why did the Secretary of State suddenly reinstate then a portion of the purged voters before yesterday's hearing?
Yeah, just a couple hours before yesterday's hearing, 22,000 were put back into an active status on the voter rolls because they figured out, partially because of court filings from Fair Fight, the cutoff date, they were putting it in May of 2012 instead of all the way back to January in 2012. And so that allowed 22,000 to have a kind of a recent contact and put them back on the rolls. What Fair Fight wants is for that period to be extended all the way back until January 1st of 2010 to say anyone who's had contact from January 1st, 2010 going forward, which includes those 100,000 voters, that all of those voters should be put back on the rolls.
Let's take a step back to get larger context. Georgia is not the only state to purge. Recently, we mentioned Wisconsin. Ohio has also thrown out thousands of absentee ballot applications, all done under a law known as Use It or Lose It. Explain what that is and how aggressive Georgia is compared to those other states.
Use It or Lose It has been a very controversial notion in the last few years, and we've seen these voter purges or voter cancellations. We've seen these an increase in these, especially in southern states in the last 5 or 6 years. And the argument from the Secretary of State's office, at least here in Georgia, has been that we need to eliminate any possibility of voter fraud. We saw in the case of Ohio where they were not matching signatures and throwing out absentee applications. And so the argument from voting rights groups is we should be making it easier to register to vote and to vote and not putting all these obstacles in voters' ways.
I mean, that's a fair argument. If this is about voter fraud, I'm sure the argument has been there are other ways to maintain the integrity of the voting system without purging. There are other ways to secure the system, correct?
There are some new systems which are going to take a better opportunity to coordinate between states as far as if you've moved to another state, they're going to have this new system which allows states to talk to each other to figure out who's moved where, who should be on the rolls, and who shouldn't be on the rolls.
Yeah, this isn't the first time Georgia has purged the rolls. I think many of us remember back in 2017, then Secretary of State Brian Kemp, who is now the governor, purged more than 500,000 voters from the rolls. We're all thinking ahead to the impact on the presidential primary in March. What have people been talking about there in Georgia?
I think people are paying a lot more attention to it now. I think if you look back to 2017, it may have not made as much news, but now it definitely is making a lot of news. And you see these court fights just over going down to the individual voter level as far as this person is still here, is still willing to vote, still can vote. And so I think that all goes back to still some very heightened emotions over that governor's race in 2018 between, as you mentioned, Brian Kemp, who is then the Secretary of State here in Georgia, and Stacey Abrams, who founded the group Fair Fight. We're still kind of reliving and going through that. But I think now people are paying a lot more attention to these voter list removals.
Emil Moffitt is a reporter at WABE in Atlanta. Thank you so much for joining us, Emil.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Democratic presidential candidates met in Los Angeles last night for their sixth and final debate of the year. And because of this line, America woke up this morning to a new meme.
So the mayor just recently had a fundraiser that was held in a wine cave full of crystals and served $900 a bottle wine.
That was Elizabeth Warren upping her battle with Mayor Pete Buttigieg for hosting fundraisers with rich people. Let's talk about that and other news in social media this week with Femi Okey. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hey, Femi.
Hello there, Peter.
So two
words. I'm in
words.
My wine cave.
Yes, well,
my microphone.
And I guess hashtag wine cave is now a thing.
People are sharing their versions of what a wine cave looks like for them. So we have people with a wine box and a straw, very relatable. A shoe closet also doubles as somebody else's wine cave.
I guess.
On a more serious, critical note, there was another hashtag doing the rounds last night, and that is hashtag wine cave Pete, where people were actually criticising the mayor for how he was doing his fundraising. For example, Roseanne DeMauro says, as by way of her analysis, she thinks the mayor will take anyone's money. I'm for sale, i.e. the mayor's for sale. Warren gets under Pete's skin so deeply. That was her takeaway from Wine Cave Pete.
And to be fair, Pete Buttigieg says Elizabeth Warren did the same thing when she was a Senate candidate and is now using that money in her presidential race. So there was another moment from the debate that I want you to weigh in on. People may not know this, but former Vice President Joe Biden grew up with a stutter. And that issue came up last night when he mentioned some of the people that he meets on the campaign trail.
My wife and I have a call list of somewhere between 20 and 100 people that we call at least every week or every month to tell them I'm here. I give them my private phone number. They keep in touch with me. The little kid who says I can't talk. What do I do? I have scores of these young women and men.
Now, after this moment, former White House press secretary Sarah Sanders mocked Biden in a tweet. Then Biden responded and Sanders apologized.
She was basically in tweet form, was doing a mock stutter. And she says, I have absolutely no idea what Biden is talking about. But she used several letters so it looked like a stutter. People were horrified by this because most of the people online knew that Joe Biden had this history of overcoming his own stutter. Let me give you just one example of a very powerful response. This comes from Nathaniel. He identifies himself as a young Republican and says to Joe Biden, Sarah will never have the class that you do. Ignore it, Joe. You are better than her. Sarah Sanders then, having taken down the tweet where she was making fun of Joe Biden, and Joe Biden tweets her, she says, I actually didn't know that about you, i.e. that you stuttered. That is commendable that you overcame your stutter. I apologize and should have made my point respectfully. Interesting.
What about
that? Almost
that?
Never happens.
Oh, my gosh.
An apology.
on social
and
media.
Respectfulness, yes,
wow.
I know, amazing.
Well, thank God for
that. So that was a little Twitter storm that happened as the debate was happening, and that erupted online.
All right, stepping away from politics, what about this picture from actor Kumail Nanjiani? He spent a year preparing his body, quite literally, for a Marvel movie, and he released a picture with, I don't know what other way to put it, he's a very buff guy, and he didn't have a shirt on. A lot of people didn't like it.
And a lot of people loved it.
Right.
He also talked about the reality of he had movie money behind him, he had a dietitian, he had a trainer, and the only way that you can look that cut is with that kind of help. A lot of people were commenting, a lot of, what on earth? Oh my goodness. And then this one just made me laugh from Judd Apatow, the director. I look like this too with my shirt off, but I don't go showing it off.
Yeah, right.
And that just, it was hilarious. But it's a very intimidating body. But he does say, I can't do this without help.
That's some self-awareness there. Femi Ok, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Hey everyone, it's Guy Raz here. So I began hosting NPR's TED Radio Hour 7 years ago, and our next episode of TED Radio Hour, well, it'll actually be my last one. It's called Life Lessons, and it's got some incredible ideas and insights, including some of the lessons I've learned over the years. Listen now.
British lawmakers today approved Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Brexit bill that paves the way for the United Kingdom to leave the European Union on January 31st, 2020.
The ayes to the right were 358. The noes to the left were 234. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Yeah.
Today's vote in the House of Commons came just a week after Johnson's Conservative Party won a big majority in last week's early election, which the Prime Minister had called hoping for exactly that result. BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson joins us from Westminster. And Rob, the million-dollar question, does this mean there's no turning back now? Does the UK is going to leave the European Union?
It does, and you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. You could talk about all sorts of other things today, but the big takeaway, there's now no doubt Britain is officially leaving the European Union, and it will do so at the end of January.
Okay, so a thing that a lot of us are thinking about at this time, though, is that it was just January of this year that Parliament rejected Theresa May's Brexit deal by 230 votes, an historic margin. What happened today is a huge personal victory for Boris Johnson, isn't it?
Oh, undoubtedly. And I should say as well, I was been over in Parliament talking to pro-Brexit Conservative MPs. I mean, they are triumphant. And you have to remember, not so much for Mr. Johnson, but many Conservatives, I mean, they have dreamed of Britain leaving the European Union pretty much ever since it joined in the 1970s. So be in no doubt, this is an historic moment. I throw in one thing as well. I mean, this is undoubtedly a triumph for Boris Johnson, but it's important to remember that the result of the election is as much the main opposition Labour Party losing it as the Conservatives winning. After all, Mr. Johnson only added a couple of 100,000 votes to what Mrs. May got in 2017, whereas the Labour Party lost over 2.5 million votes.
We've heard lots of spirited discussions before, but how would you characterize the debate today?
So that's a really good question. I'd characterize it as basically lacking some of the tension that's been there. And that, of course, is what those who are pro-Brexit want. They want the country to they want the Remainers to accept, look, we've lost, Britain is leaving, let's all move on. I mean, and that was the typically colourful plea from Mr. Johnson, who likened it to Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, saying, let's put behind leave and remain Capulets and Montagues. So it's true that a certain amount of the tension had gone out of it. I mean, this was a Conservative Party that's triumphant. I mean, I think that, again, is the big hope of the Johnson administration, that after 3.5 years of astonishing bitter division, some of that sort of passion and poison will have gone out of the debate.
One last question for you while I have you. If Brexit is now sorted, does the focus now turn to this new fight over Scottish independence?
Absolutely. So Mr. Johnson is going to have this difficulty of negotiating that future relationship with the EU against a backdrop of potentially constant challenges from the pro-independent Scottish National Party demanding another vote on independence. And I should say also having to be very mindful of sectarian divisions in Northern Ireland. So, yep, absolutely triumphant moment for Mr. Johnson. Are there huge challenges ahead? You betcha.
The BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson in London. As always, Rob, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Well, it's that time of year, and ballet companies are focusing on their financial mainstay, the Nutcracker. That's expected. But this season has also brought something less familiar. In New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and elsewhere, major companies are featuring choreography directed by women. And as reporter Sharon Basco explains, it's a new era for women in ballet.
Look around the dance world, and what you'll see this year is a wealth of ballets by women, works by Helen Pickett, Kathy Marston, Pam Tanowitz, and New York City Ballet principal Lauren Lovett, who says it hasn't always been this way.
I believe I've seen a huge change in the past 3 years. There's a lot more growth and opportunity for women.
Lovett is on the leading edge of that change. She was freed from sugar plum duty for all of last year's Nutcracker season and given time to choreograph. Lovett said she felt guilty, stepping away from 10 weeks of shared drudgery.
I've done it for 10 years, so a lot of sugar plum fairy performances, a lot of snowflake shows.
When Lovett shucked her tutu for studio sweats, she earned rave reviews. The New York Times called her work the future of the art form, where women can become ballet choreographers.
When girls and young women see someone like them choreographing or leading a company, they understand through example that they can achieve this, do this as well.
That's Helen Pickett, a prominent choreographer. Pickett succeeded despite the No Girls Allowed atmosphere. But she was an exception. 4 years ago, Here and Now reported that major companies went year after year without a single ballet made by a woman. In the 2012-2013 season, choreographer Amy Seiwert researched ballet troupes with budgets exceeding $5 million. She found that of 290 ballets staged that year, just 25 were choreographed by women. People began to take notice. When he retired from the New York Times last year, critic Alistair McCauley wrote a farewell essay in which he expressed regrets.
I wrote a piece in which I mentioned in passing that one of the things I wish I would have given more attention to was the status of women in ballet, in particular women as choreographers.
McCauley points to an awakening in the past few years, and changes are underway, starting with several companies hiring female artistic directors.
One, of course, is Washington Ballet, which is directed by Julie Kent. Another is Miami City Ballet, which is directed by Lourdes Lopez.
That's dance scholar and author Lynn Garofola. She says that female leadership should bring more opportunity for women.
At one time, I was perhaps extremely optimistic that women artistic directors would translate into hiring women choreographers. I think Tamara Rojo at the English National Ballet is one of those cases.
I am Tamara Rojo, and I am artistic director of English National Ballet. It was a very conscious decision to actually create a full evening of female choreographers. I set out to do that because in my 22 years as a professional dancer, I had never been part of a commission by any female choreographer. I had never, in fact, performed any piece choreographed by a woman. And I didn't think that was right. And then as soon as I was in a position to make a difference, I did. I thought it was my responsibility.
Come down stage a bit, Gabs.
Seen that all the major companies were looking at us and that they have started to pay attention and commission women. And as I said, today will be very, very strange for any company to announce a season where there is no female representation.
A new advocacy research group called the Dance Data Project backs up Rojo's experience. Major troupes are acquiring work by women, but slowly. This season, fewer than 20% of ballets are by female choreographers. And Lynn Garofolo notes that the women commissioned for major work do so mainly as freelancers, not resident choreographers.
Someone like Helen Pickett has been very successful in finding work, and she works with a variety of companies. I don't think she's really had the luxury of an institutional home.
But today we have a woman choreographer who enjoys the security of a home base, 27-year-old Lauren Lovett with the New York City Ballet. But if you're thinking that women have arrived, she says you could bump up against a new glass ceiling, the uncomfortable subject of equal pay.
I think that is the next step. It's like, okay, thank you for giving me an opportunity. Now, will you pay me the same?
If there are equal seats at the table, if we manage to get some kind of equal pay, equity in the number of jobs given, I think we'd be cooking with gas, as my dad says.
Helen Pickett turns the conversation to another quandary, outside expectations when women are given the chance to create ballets.
There has been a mindset in the past, you know, we have to choose a good female choreographer so she represents and does not fail. Well, that by proxy will fail.
Lynn Garofolo offers the wisdom of an historian.
Balanchine made an awful lot of mediocre works, and the same thing goes for many, many other choreographers. So women have to be allowed to fail. They have to be allowed to do works that are mediocre without saying that every time they choreograph something, it has to be a masterpiece.
So there's still a long way to go. But Tamara Rojo says the movement is headed in the right direction.
When we started, it was seen as a very rare thing to commission specifically work by women to create a full program around women. But since then, I have seen already a change.
Critic Alistair McCulley agrees.
Suddenly, since 2015, this has become a movement, and there's actually something called the Women's Movement as a choreographic initiative at American Ballet Theatre, and many other American companies are doing the same, British companies also. So a whole trend has started in the last 4 or 5 years. But I wish I had been wider awake to it before 2015.
It would have helped women choreographers if critics had earlier realized the inequities. But with eyes open now, Helen Pickett is hopeful.
This is the ground we walk on now, that we walk on now. And let's keep going forward with that.
For Here and Now, I'm Sharon Basco.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
Disappointing news at the holidays for steelworkers in Michigan. U.S. Steel says it plans to close its iron and steelmaking operations at its Great Lakes work site outside of Detroit. Up to 1,500 jobs are at risk, raising the question of just how much the president's steel tariffs have helped the domestic steel industry. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, what do we know so far about these closures?
Well, Peter, like you said, it's more than 1,500 jobs at facilities in Michigan. And this announcement really comes amid a flurry of other bad news about U.S. Steel. They basically warned investors that they lost a lot of money in the fourth quarter and that they'll have to drastically reduce the dividend they pay on their stock. The one thing about these plants that I would add, however, is the company refers to this as idling the plants mm-hmm. rather than permanently shutting them down. So in theory, that means they could be brought back up online and some of the jobs restored in the future if the market conditions are favorable. You know, I know that's little solace to the people who lost the jobs, but it doesn't sound like it's a permanent closure right. necessarily.
Right. Those jobs might come back. All right. U.S. Steel shares are down about 60%. For the year. Tell me more about that. Why is the company struggling so much?
Well, one of the big problems is, you know, in theory, the tariffs on imported steel should have helped U.S. steel makers. But the rest of the trade war has really done a lot of damage to the manufacturing industry in the country. It's basically shrinking. You know, it's being called a manufacturing recession because of all the uncertainty and the tariffs in the trade war. And those are basically U.S. Steel's main customers. And on top of that, U.S. Steel itself, apart from the trends in the industry, it's really struggled with its strategy. It has a lot of aging plants that really need massive overhauls to be more efficient and more safe. Their competitors have much more technologically advanced plants that they're competing with. So they've had this sort of shifting strategy on how to deal with that. And this is kind of the latest chapter of that.
Now, I also see that the natural gas market is down about, the prices are down about 45% this year, which also might be connected to this problem at U.S. Steel, right?
I think it's a part of the headwind for the company overall. But when you think about how U.S. Steel works, it basically locates some of these plants near their biggest customers. So, for example, for the energy, the oil and gas drillers in Texas, there is a mill there that produces the pipes they need. These plants we're talking about are near Detroit. Their biggest customers are the auto industry. So one of the things that was sort of the final nail in the coffin for these plants was the big GM strike in the fall that kind of really hurt their main customers for about a month there.
I want to hear from this clip from President Trump. He was in Pennsylvania in August talking to workers about the future of the industry.
Okay, I don't want to be overly crude. Your business was dead. And I put a little thing called a 25% tariff on all of the dump steel all over the country. And now your business is thriving.
Just quickly, Mike, what do you make of that? I mean, it is true that it got better for a while in the steel industry.
I think the issue is, apart from being overly crude or not, President Trump is overly unpredictable. It's basically a strategy of his. And that makes it very difficult for companies like U.S. Steel that need to make these massive long-term investments to really know what to do.
Yeah. Mike Regan, Bloomberg News. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Last night's debate between contenders for the Democratic presidential nomination saw the top polling candidates weathering attacks on healthcare experiences and big money donors. Bernie Sanders criticized Joe Biden, the front runner in national polls, and Pete Buttigieg, who leads polls in Iowa.
Now, there's a real competition going on up here. My good friend Joe, and he is a good friend, he's received contributions from 44 billionaires. Pete, on the other hand, is trailing. Pete, you only got 39 billionaires contributing. So, Pete, we look forward to you. I know you're an energetic guy and a competitive guy to see if you could take on Joe on that issue. But what is not a laughing matter, my friends, this is why three people own more wealth than the bottom half. This is why Amazon and other major corporations pay zero in federal taxes. We need to get money out of politics. We should run our campaigns on that basis.
Thank you, Senator Sanders. Vice President Biden, 45 seconds to respond.
My average contribution is $43, number one. That's number one. Number two, the idea that that the senator is suggesting that I am in the pocket of billionaires, when in fact they oppose everything that I have ever done and continue to do. I have made sure from the very beginning, every one of my fundraisers is open to the press, every single solitary one, not one single time, period. And I've made sure that you know exactly where all the largest contribution I've accepted is $2,800, which is allowed under law. And I'm the first person to introduce the constitutional amendment to make sure that there is no all public funding of elections and all private funding. And we all should make a commitment to that right now on this stage. In the meantime, you got to fund a campaign. And we, in fact, have funded a campaign, average contribution, $43.
Thank you, Vice President.
Race was also an issue as Democrats grapple how best to energize a base of Black, Latino and Asian American voters. All but one of the candidates on stage last night were white. The one Asian American, Andrew Yang, was asked what message that sends to voters.
It's both an honor and disappointment to be the lone candidate of color on the stage tonight. I miss Kamala, I miss Corey, though I think Corey will be back. I grew up the son of immigrants, and I had many racial epithets used against me as a kid. But Black and Latinos have something much more powerful working against them than words. They have numbers. The average net worth of a Black household is only 10% that of a white household. For Latinos, it's 12%. If you're a Black woman, you're 320% more likely to die from complications in childbirth. These are the numbers that define race in our country.
For those ages 18 to 23, also known as Gen Zers, the topic of diversity is an important one. And this presidential election is the first time many of them will be voting. We decided to check in with some of these emerging voters here in California. A bus full of high school and college students headed to Loyola Marymount University in L.A. to a watch party in a building a block away from the debate stage. Here and Now producer Christina Kim joined them to learn more about the issues and candidates that matter most to them during this upcoming election.
Everyone on this bus was born after 1996. Popularly called Gen Zers, many of them will come of age this election. They're racially and ethnically more diverse than any previous generation in U.S. history. And a third of them identify as independents.
I don't think I identify with any party, really.
Isabel Misropian is a high school senior from Santa Clarita, California. She'll be 18 this November. She and her family were evacuated from their home during the Saddle Ridge wildfire earlier this year.
We didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know if the fire was close to us. We didn't know if it was affecting our house at all. It was just dangerous because a lot of the brush around us, we're in the desert, basically.
Misropian says she's most concerned about things that impact her life now, like climate change, and decisions that will impact her future.
I'm going into college soon, and it's getting more expensive as the years go on. And I don't know if it stops. I don't know if it'll ever stop. And I don't know how my family's going to pay for it. I don't know how I'm going to pay for it as a parent for my child if it continues to rise. And then cost of living also is an interesting topic. It's a very, I don't know, nothing's happening for that. There's a lot that can be done for it. It's difficult for students to have that much hope that they'll be able to have their own place, you know, have their own life, because it just seems to get more and more expensive and jobs are paying barely anymore to keep up with it.
18-year-old Fernando Cienfuegos is a freshman at the University of Southern California. His top issue, like many of the Gen Zers I spoke with here, is immigration.
I come from a predominantly Latino community as well as a low-income base, and there's a lot of students that are dealing with the whole sort of what's going to happen to DACA and, you know, the fears that unfortunately this administration has placed into a lot of people in my community is the fear of being deported and being broken away or separated from your family.
Cienfuegos' father was deported when he was 10 and is still back in Mexico.
And I wouldn't want anyone to go through what I went through. And those types of repercussions that it leaves on you, you know, within your mental health and the types of relationships you have, those are things that I wouldn't wish upon anyone. I really hope that, you know, our country and our leadership understands that those are types of things that you can't just let politics, you know, hash out. These are things that have to be spoken about without partisan ideals.
18-year-old high school senior John Polk is from Santa Clarita. It was the first city in California to break away from the state sanctuary law, which prohibits local and state agencies from cooperating with immigration officials on misdemeanors. John is also interested in how the presidential candidates will address immigration reform.
So I don't favor something like Trump's, you know, like Muslim ban that when he first got into office. I don't like anything that kind of hard right, but I do think that it's important as a country that we maintain our borders and that we do have a strong policy that makes sure that, like, people coming in illegally they shouldn't just be allowed to, you know, walk in and get citizenship or anything like that. Like, so I would definitely side more with the Republicans on that.
Bucking perceptions that paint Gen Zers almost as unilaterally progressive, John considers himself a conservative independent and isn't sure who will get his vote in 2020. But some Democratic candidates have piqued his interest.
One and two for me would be Andrew Yang and Bernie Sanders. I think the reason I love them, and this just speaks so much to where we are right now, I think, is that I think we're centered around more candidates than, like, their policy almost, like them as people more than what they're proposing. And I think that's kind of how Trump, you know, got elected in the first place.
But John hasn't lost faith in President Trump, despite the impeachment process.
He didn't really have my support when he first ran. I mean, I couldn't vote, but, like, I wasn't a fan of him. He's grown on me, and we'll have to wait and see till the election. I don't know how everything's going to unfold. If And it also depends on the Democratic nominee. If he runs against someone like Biden, I'm probably going Trump. If he runs against someone like Bernie, I don't know. That's more of a toss-up. But I'd probably lean more towards Trump.
Cienfuegos, the freshman from USC, still hasn't made up his mind yet. And despite their mostly opposing views on immigration, he and John share one candidate in common.
But right now I'm looking at Andrew Yang. I actually just met him. It was really awesome.
But he also says he has his sights on what some might call an underdog.
And I'm also looking at Julian Castro. I'd love to see a Latino president. You know, I think that'd be a very big win for us. Barack Obama was a champion towards that. He really proved that minorities could make a difference and that they aren't supposed to be sort of like, they shouldn't have their ideas set on, I'm not going to be reaching that position. I could never. It's a different community dominated by a different race. Like, that's not going to happen. He completely proved us wrong, and I think that in doing so, it allows candidates like Julian Castro and candidates like Andrew Yang, who are not your typical quintessential white politician, to make and break that space. And so I really hope that either of those two candidates succeed.
Isabel Misropia says she's interested in two rather different Democratic candidates.
I'm definitely excited about Bernie Sanders, just because he's very popular among people my age, but also he seems very passionate about everything. I've seen pictures of him as a young man at protests and things, and seeing a politician who's that active and that vocal, he doesn't seem to curb his speech. He's very honest, very open about what he believes, and that's very important. Also, Joe Biden's pretty interesting. He's less professional as most politicians, which kind of is a little nerve-wracking, but he's experienced. He was the vice president, so that's he's got some experience in that kind of realm.
It would be easy to define this generation as a massive voting bloc and ascribe overarching characteristics to them. But perhaps what unites these three young voters is their refusal to be defined. For Here and Now, I'm Christina Kim.
We've been reporting lately on the housing affordability crisis in America, and the issue literally hits close to home for our next guest. Jillian Johnson is a city councilwoman and the mayor pro tem of Durham, North Carolina, and she's trying to put a dent in the city's rising home prices by turning the once empty lot next to her house into a duplex. She posted this video of a tractor clearing dirt in her yard last month. The three-bedroom units will be affordable for people who make 80% of the area's median income. Jillian, Councilwoman, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And it looks like you just broke ground on this project. Tell me more. What were you thinking? What's the plan?
Yeah, so I own this piece of property for about 15 years. It came with my house when I bought my house, and my neighborhood's become a lot more expensive in the time that I've lived there, and I wanted to put the land to good use for the neighborhood, so I decided to build a duplex there.
We've been having conversations with people around the country about building affordable housing, and the takeaway for me is that it's very hard to do. And here you are building a duplex in your backyard, essentially. What kind of hurdles have you faced doing this?
So I live in a historic district. That was the first kind of regulatory hurdle that I had to figure out. And I think it's really good for me as a city official to see the process from the outside and see what folks have to go through in order to do a project like this. Part of the reason that nothing had ever been built on the lot before is the topography. It has kind of a steep slope in the back. And so we've had to design the house and also do quite a bit of grading and site work in order to accommodate that slope.
And it's not like you're a developer, so this is all new to you.
No, I honestly have no idea what I'm doing.
But you're doing it.
But I'm doing it, exactly. No, I mean, I brought folks in to help me out. There are folks out digging up my yard right now, getting the pilings in for the foundation. So it's fun to watch.
The obvious question is, how do you pay for this?
Yeah, I'm going into a lot of debt.
Really?
Yep, I'm borrowing the money and hoping that the rent will break even on the debt, but I'm relying on appreciation. I live in a gentrifying neighborhood. Homes have been appreciating very quickly, so I don't, even if I subsidize the rent a little bit, I don't think I'll lose money in the long term.
Well, and how are you approaching this? Is it as an investment in which you hope to make money, or is it as something that you're doing sort of for the public good? And if you don't make money, that would be okay with you.
Yeah, I'm not anticipating making money. My goal is to break even, but given the way costs have escalated over the course of the project, it's likely that keeping the rent at 80% of AMI will not allow me to break even, at least in the beginning. And I'm okay with that. That's a commitment that I made to ensure that it's affordable, and I'm going to carry through with that regardless.
So for people who are not familiar with Durham, this is home to Duke University. It's part of North Carolina's Research Triangle. But, you know, it's also been a working class city over the years. Can you just explain how much the need is and how much of an affordability crisis the city's been facing?
Sure. It's pretty severe. We recently passed a $95 million housing bond to try to put a dent in the issue.
Just last month, right?
Just last month, exactly. The voters approved it by an over 70% margin. So that was really exciting for us to see how much our community really cares about affordability and about making a difference. Our biggest issue, you know, is growth. And it's both a blessing and a curse. We have had a lot of people moving to our community over the last 20 years, and we are seeing a lot of development, but it hasn't been enough. And of course, most of the housing that we're seeing being built is, you know, luxury apartment complexes, housing that most folks who have lived in Durham for a long time or lower income people who are moving to Durham can't afford. And my neighborhood, there are several new apartment complexes within a mile of my home that have been built in the last few years that where the, you know, the rents are incredibly high for Durham.
And you've got this $95 million affordable housing bond, so that may help. But, you know, on the other hand, not everybody can build one of these duplexes in their backyard, and it's just two units that you're doing.
Exactly.
Do you expect to make much of a difference with this project? Is that the goal?
No, I mean, I think that it's important for everyone to do what they can. This is a very small project. It's not going to change my neighborhood. It's not going to change Durham, but it is it's being a part of the solution. And that's what I want to do, what I want to model, and what I want everyone in our community to try to do, whether that's providing affordable units, providing donations to our Affordable Housing Trust Fund, being an advocate in the community for housing affordability. I think we are going to need all of that moving forward.
That's Jillian Johnson. She is a councilwoman and mayor pro tem of Durham, North Carolina, also taking a stab at developing affordable housing literally in her own backyard. Jillian, thanks for your time. Good luck.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And what's the saying? Put the money where the mouth is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
Icelanders take some of their holiday prep outdoors, bearing pots of sweet rye dough and boiling volcanic sand to bake.
My grandmother used to do this, and my mother, and a lot of the local people. Like anywhere else in the world, you know, life changes. But this has always been the same.
A tradition that goes back to the age of Vikings, next time on Here and Now.